You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The foundations of classical liberalism were laid out in the works of Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and then refined in the 19th century by John Stuart Mill. Its primary characteristics include the promotion of social reforms like women's rights, labor unions, universal education, housing for the poor, and improvement of public health. In his latest book, Pulitzer Prize winner Chris Hedges argues that all of those reforms have been abandoned by the new liberal class. Death of the Liberal Class is published by Nation Books. I'm very pleased that it brings Chris Hedges back to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
You begin your book with the story of Ernest Logan Bell, an unemployed 25-year-old Marine Corps veteran who's walking along Route 12 in upstate New York. Why did you decide to tell his story?
Because it's emblematic of what's happened to the working class in this country, the disenfranchisement of the working class, that swinging, as he does, which I find fascinating, between a right-wing populism, libertarianism. He's sort of all over the map. Sympathy for the Tea Party movements, and at the same time a kind of begrudging respect for Denis Kucinich, and how I think the liberal establishment has failed figures like Bell.
Well, when he goes to a Tea Party meeting and he says, I like Denis Kucinich, isn't he considered a weirdo?
I think that there's a certain amount of confusion on the part of those people who have a legitimate rage that are leaping up around the fringes of society. It is a populism. It's probably a right-wing populism. But he's a huge supporter of Ron Paul, and yet at the same time, he wants unemployment benefits not only extended but widened. He himself is unemployed, struggling, as many people in upstate New York are. So I think he embodies a lot of the contradictions within the movement.
And you say his few job prospects other than the military.
Well, exactly. He is a Marine Corps veteran. And for the signing bonus of $20,000, he signed back up for the New York National Guard, which is training to deploy to Afghanistan.
Would we say liberals are more responsible than conservatives for the growth of the military-industrial complex and what you've called a permanent state of war?
I wouldn't say they're more, but they've certainly been acquiescent. If you go back to the 1960s, there were certainly the liberal wing of the Democratic Party would, while they might not fight the sort of permanent war economy, they would fight specific weapon systems. That's gone. There's no ability to defy the permanent war economy within the liberal class. There's complete collaboration.
Well, there was a time when people like Scoop Jackson represented the what people saw as a more conservative wing of the Democratic Party. Are you suggesting that most Democrats today are Scoop Jackson Democrats?
Not always in their rhetoric, but certainly in the way they vote, yes.
You also make the case that churches have let their congregations down by not challenging war and the erosion of their rights. Haven't many churches really been more concerned about issues like abortion and gay marriage so that they pretty much ignored all these other issues?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, that of course was driven not by liberal religious institutions but by conservative or right-wing Christian right institutions, and I think the liberal class fell into that, arguing about these social issues rather than the more fundamental issue of economic justice, which is something the church did address. Certainly during the civil rights movement became a major theme at the end of Martin Luther King's life.
And others, the Berrigan brothers,
for example. Exactly.
The Catholic Church had Cardinal Spellman blessing troops as they went off to Vietnam to fight godless communism. And then you had the Berrigan brothers. You had William Sloan Coffin.
Right.
Is there nobody like that today?
I don't see them out there. I was raised in the church. I graduated from seminary, Presbyterian. And what's happened within the Presbyterian church and other mainstream denominations is they're essentially split between an aging – what we would call classically liberal constituency and a rising evangelical constituency. And this has really disabled church leaders who don't want to offend either constituency.
But haven't many churches historically tended to support the establishment? For example, when the churches told the miners in Kentucky in the early 20th century that they shouldn't strike even though their working conditions were terrible and they hardly got any decent wages.
Yeah. I mean, the institutional church throughout from the third century onward has a pretty sordid record in terms of its acquiescence to the power elite. And yet within the church, I mean, take the Southern Baptists. They would be a very good example. Until the sort of coup of 1980, which was orchestrated by figures by Al Moyer when they took over the denomination and took over Southern Baptist Seminary, which was one of the great seminaries of the United States, expelling women, all of the women faculty, you had a kind of conservatism around social issues, homosexuality. They were very was unacceptable, abortion.
They believed in racial separation?
And racial, but very connected to the issues of the working class. And that was destroyed. So I think the record is more mixed. You're certainly right that the hierarchy, especially often within the Catholic Church, was one that was hostile to workers' interests. But then probably the greatest encyclical on labor was also produced in Vatican II.
And there have been any number of Jesuits who have been involved in leftist causes.
And Dorothy Day. I mean, that Christian anarchist movement, which I have deep admiration for, and I interview Daniel Berrigan. He's one of the interviews in this book.
You argue that the right-wing backlash against the liberal elites is an expression of the liberal class's flagrant betrayal of the citizenry. Are liberals more elitist than conservatives? Because the word gets applied to them more.
Yeah. Well, the liberal class, I mean, that's the elitism of the liberal class is one of the problems. And I think one of the reasons that you've had this disconnect between this liberal establishment and the dispossessed or disenfranchised working class. So that with the passage of NAFTA and the assault against workers, the dismanufacturing of our manufacturing base, the slashing of state and federal programs, the Clintons' so-called welfare reform, the deregulation of the banks, you had the traditional liberal class supporting, if not certainly supporting political figures who carried this out. And I think that that has created a tremendous rupture between it's probably wrong at this point to call them a working class, but our sort of permanent underclass and the liberal establishment.
But there seems to be a lot of confusion here, not just Ernest Logan Bell, the man you started off with, but a lot of people in the Tea Party who support mm-hmm. somebody like Rand Paul, who would eliminate Social Security and Medicare and pretty much all social services. And yet this is a kind of a populist backlash against liberals who instituted all of those things.
They did. And for me, the tragedy of the liberal class and the liberal institutions that are, I think, the pillars of the liberal establishment is that rhetorically they continue to do so. But
well, didn't they just try to get an extension on unemployment benefits through Congress and it was voted down?
Yeah. Well, I mean, here we're seeing essentially, I think, the utter disempowering of what's left of the remnants of a liberal establishment by an obstructionist Republican Party that has come in and is quite willing to inflict a lot of suffering on Americans to toss Obama out. I find Obama and the Democrats to have been too acquiescent to the demands of the corporate state, and I think that this has been a terrible error, terrible misjudgment on their part.
Are liberals considered guiltier because they promised to help the underclass?
Yes, because traditionally the liberal establishment of the Democratic Party the press used to have, you know, I worked for the New York Times. We used to all have labor reporters. I think the Times may still, but most papers don't. They had labor reporters. They watched out for the interests of those outside the power elite, including the working class, which is why labor has traditionally supported the Democratic Party. All of that's gone. I think part of the anger towards the liberal class is not misplaced because it became deeply hypocritical. It continued to speak in this rhetoric and yet supported policies, globalization, the NAFTA, all sorts of policies that have really wreaked havoc with the working class in this country.
My guest is Chris Hedges. His latest book, Death of the Liberal Class, it's published by Nation Books. Well, how much of this is in response to the fact that the Democrats have been hurt by the perception that they have been too sympathetic in many people's eyes to the poor, especially poor people of color? When Lyndon Johnson passed through any number of legislative acts. He was told that the Democrats would suffer. And then came Nixon with the Southern Strategy, and the Democrats have suffered.
I think, I mean, that's certainly very true, but I think that it was more craven than that, and it was really under Clinton that the Bill Clinton understood that he could serve corporate interests, and if he did serve corporate interest, he could get corporate money. So that by the 1990s, he had fundraising parity with the Republicans. Of course, he had to do corporate bidding, as we saw with many of the legislative issues that I just mentioned. And by the time Barack Obama ran for president, he actually got more. But
Bill Clinton was president during a time of economic boom in this country. Unemployment was down. We were running. We didn't have any deficits. Wasn't he doing a good job?
Well,
many conservatives, many Tea Party people cited him as a role model.
Well, Bill Clinton was a very effective Republican president, and he pushed through a lot of policies that Wall Street and the corporate elite wanted pushed through. But the consequences down the road of that have been catastrophic. The banking crisis, the financial crisis can be laid – certainly the banking crisis is laid at the feet of his Treasury Secretary, Lawrence Summers, who ripped down Glass-Steagall. It's why Canada doesn't have a banking crisis, and we lose over 100 banks go bust every year.
Of course, Ireland is having a worse banking crisis. Does that mean that they didn't have Glass-Steagall?
I don't know enough about the Irish financial system, a lot of these derivatives were bought up all throughout Europe. These toxic assets were sold to many European banks, which is why they're suffering.
Many would argue that much of the backlash against Barack Obama from Tea Partiers and others has more to do with the color of his skin than of a rejection of his policies.
Well, this is what I find so disturbing, because these and I think as we started at the top of the show, there is a great deal of confusion about the ideology of the Tea Party movement, as you pointed out. And it doesn't it's not really a coherent policy, but it has an emotional consistency. And I think that part of that emotional consistency is a not very hidden racism many in the Tea Party movement, at least from what I can observe, embrace. And they use coded language to express it, but I think you're right. I think it is racist and, of course, deeply disturbing, because what we have is a liberal class that continues to speak in sort of the dead language of policies and issues.
And what should they be speaking in?
Well, I think we have to recognize that rage that is expressed through the Tea Party movement is a legitimate rage, that these people have been betrayed. And unfortunately, that rage is being manipulated by hate mongers, people like Glenn Beck, Sarah Palin, the religious right, and they push a lot of buttons, including the one you pointed out, which I think is racism.
On the other hand, isn't it always the case that when a Democrat is elected president, these things flare up? Bill Clinton, we should not forget, was impeached. When the Bush administration was running up incredible deficits, we didn't hear anything from these people who are complaining about deficits. They only came out of the woodwork when Barack Obama became president.
Well, I certainly don't want to be put in a position to defend the Republican Party. I think you're very right.
No, but I'm not talking about the Republican Party. I'm talking about people who protest under certain circumstances and look the other way under others. I mean, a lot of people are very upset about the war in Afghanistan, but at the same time, they forget that the United States entered that war and the war in Iraq under a previous administration. And when people complained or criticized, they were called unpatriotic.
Right, except that I think with the Tea Party movement, it has been as much an assault at the Republican Party establishment as it has been at the Democratic Party establishment, and that makes it different. That this is a movement that it doesn't speak in a rational or coherent ideology. It is about emotion, and it is primarily about anger and hatred.
My guest is Chris Hedges, who's a fellow at the Nation Institute. He spent nearly 2 years as a foreign correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, won a Pulitzer Prize during his 15 years for the New York Times. And he's the author of a number of bestsellers, Empire of Illusion, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and American Fascists. These days, he's a columnist for Truthdig, and The book we are discussing is Death of the Liberal Class. It's published by Nation Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Chris Hedges, whose latest book is called Death of the Liberal Class. It's published by Nation Books. And no liberal institution has spared your analysis. You argue that the press is bankrupt. Is the press really a liberal institution?
Yes.
Isn't that what conservatives say? And then liberals say, wait a minute, most newspapers are owned by conservatives. The most dominant television news source right now is Fox.
Sure. I mean, this is part of the deformation of the American press. But I think the press, when it functions, is to give a voice to those elements within a society that without the press would not have a voice, the ordinary citizen. And the press, when it was independent and not controlled by roughly six corporations that now disseminate almost everything most Americans watch or hear, we had a diversity of voices. I understand deeply the flaws of these liberal institutions, and I'm very critical of them. Yet at the same time, I think they're vital to a functioning democracy because they function as a kind of safety valve. They provide channels by which change, incremental piecemeal change, can be made. That was what gave us the New Deal, the civil rights movement, the whole Nader consumer protection movement with allies in the Democratic Party. And as that, when you shut that valve off, then you see, as we are seeing, leaping up around the fringes of American society, these very frightening, I would describe them as sort of proto-fascist populist movements.
How do you rate your former employer, the New York Times?
Well, the Times still does what I would call reality-based journalism, which is unfortunately a dwindling commodity. It believes in a variety of voices. It reports. It believes in fact, the primacy of fact. I think, as my friend Sidney Shanberg has pointed out, the failure of institutions like the New York Times is not so much what's on their pages but what they don't put on their pages.
Well, of course, they have run into all sorts of financial difficulties,
right,
as have all newspapers.
Right.
And some of those cutbacks, I assume, are defended by the fact that they have smaller pages than they did when I first read the New York Times.
Yep, they do. Well,
fewer columns on a page.
Yeah, yeah. All of that's true, and it's very frightening because it's being replaced with, I would call it, propaganda or indoctrination masquerading as news.
What do you mean by that? I mean, the New York Times is publishing propaganda?
No, I'm saying it's being replaced by Fox. It's being replaced by a partisan news establishment that really isn't interested in the trade of reporting at all.
But the Times is under constant attack for just that sort of thing.
Well, this is ridiculous. I mean, the same way that they attack Barack Obama for being a socialist. The Democratic Party in Europe would be considered a far-right party. But of course, for the sort of rapacious right wing, this is great because the liberal class and I think the Obama White House has proven pretty ineffectual at dealing with the substantial economic dislocation and the problems we have. And so they want to paint him as a liberal to discredit, I think, those core liberal values that are the underpinning of a functioning democracy.
Now, what would have happened if Obama had supported universal health care, for example, something that liberals have argued for? He wouldn't have had a chance in hell of getting that bill through.
Well, what would have happened is, of course, Aetna and Cigna and Wellfleet and all these companies would have stopped contributing to the Democratic Party. But in polls, 80% of registered Democrats supported the public option. And I think that the timidity of the liberal establishment or, you know, the Democratic Party for whatever short-term gain they've made has proved empowering to forces within the American political establishment that I consider anti-democratic.
What about the internet? Many people claim that that has democratized news.
The internet is destroying news in the same way it's destroying all creative endeavor because there's no remuneration. There's no possibility to make a living. The yearly budget for the New York Times is about $750 million. I think they make about $200 or $250 million off their internet site. And that, that monopoly that newsprint had of connecting sellers with buyers has been obliterated. which is why, of course, major metropolitan dailies like the Philadelphia Inquirer and the San Francisco Chronicle, others are going through bankruptcy, and the Inquirer was bought by a hedge fund, which will probably harvest it to death. And so with the death of that monopoly, we're not seeing it replaced on the internet. And what we do see on the internet, there's very little reporting on the internet. I mean, people don't even pick up a phone. And what frightens me as a former newspaper reporter is that the skills of reporting are just not going to be sustained. And it's all going to be emotionally driven commentary. I mean, the ethic of the internet is the inverse of newsprint. And on the internet, you put anything out there, whether it's wrong or right. If it has an emotional appeal, it resonates. Whereas with a newspaper reporter, everything is vetted. So yes, we may make mistakes, but we strive to be as factual, as accurate, and as careful as we can. It's completely the opposite on the internet.
My guest is Chris Hedges. His latest book, Death of the Liberal Class, is published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You also rate universities poorly. What are they doing wrong?
Well, they've become completely corporatized. You have, especially with now massive cuts, departments are being told they have to raise their own money, not only for research and grants, but often for salaries. Well, if you're in the classics department, if you're in the humanities, if you're in the liberal arts, that's not going to happen, and it's not happening. The humanities are withering away, and universities are increasingly being reconfigured as vocational training schools for various layers within the corporate state. And that's very frightening, because I think a liberal arts education is fundamental to a liberal democracy in a sense that it trains you, or it teaches you, to question assumptions and structures. That's why Socrates was put to death. And when you don't even, when you lack the vocabulary by which to describe the reality around you, you're rendered impotent. And I think that there's been a tremendous – I mean, look at City College, destroyed by Nelson Rockefeller. I mean, this was one of the great universities of the country, and it gave a chance to the sons and daughters of immigrants who went on and contributed immensely to the richness of American life. All of these universities are under assault. The University of Albany just cut classics, French, Italian, German. I was out in the University of Washington. They had 10% budget cuts, so they obliterated the philosophy and the theater department. This is devastating.
But that's not corporatization. These are all public institutions as opposed to the private
universities. Because they're starved. And so what gets money? Well, it gets there's a beautiful, gleaming new business school provided with corporate donors. So the what serves the interests of the corporate state is sustained within these university structures, and what does not is allowed to die.
Are the corporations at fault for all of this? Because you keep on referring back to them.
Yeah, I think
you call them soulless corporations.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it is. Look at the healthcare, our for-profit healthcare industry. It's legally permitted in this country, in essence, to hold a sick child hostage while their parents bankrupt themselves trying to save their sons or daughters. That's the kind of system. Look what they're doing to the ecosystem. I mean, we watched in Copenhagen as they shredded Kyoto, and we're all sitting around courtesy of the propaganda machine by ExxonMobil pretending global warming isn't happening.
I read in the paper today that the insurance companies gave, I don't know whether it was millions or billions of dollars.
Yeah, 80 – that was in the New York Times editorial, yeah. 86.3 million, right, to Chamber of Commerce.
U.S. Chamber of
Commerce. To do their dirty work for them.
Which got involved in many campaign ads mm-hmm. around the country. And I was thinking, gee, if they had just taken a couple of those dollars and given it to the doctor they're denying me coverage for.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think that now we're seeing with Citizens United and the last midterm elections. I mean, for every one ad that poor Feingold was allowed to run, he was sandwiched between five or six that destroyed him. And we don't even know who's funding these ads, who's producing them.
So was there ever an effective liberal class in this country? I'm thinking back to, Harry Truman, FDR. There always have been criticisms along the lines that you're making.
Yes, except that I think that there was an effective liberal class when we had mobilized effective radical movements. Dwight MacDonald writes about how the progressive or the left in this country, socialism, was shattered in World War I with the Creel Commission, the rise of the Committee for Public Information, the sort of propaganda state that was created by the public relations industry. And the liberal class is essentially kept honest in the same way that Rampart's magazine in the 1960s kept the New York Times honest. It began reporting on issues that certainly at its inception that the New York Times wasn't reporting on. And when Ellsberg had the Pentagon Papers, he went back and forth between Rampart's and the New York Times and finally, of course, gave it to the Times and the Post.
The irony is that the man who founded Rampart's is now so far to the right that he's farther to the right than the Tea Party.
Yeah, that often happens with Trotskyites. You can look at Christopher Hitchens. People who are, you know, ideologically rigid have a very easy time. That pendulum swings very rapidly from one side to the other. Rampart's, you know, is an example. Of course, it lost money on every issue, but Rampart's is an example of how you need that sort of far left or whatever you want to call it, radical, to keep the liberal track. A liberal class from sort of drifting into the embrace of the power elite, which unfortunately I believe it has now done.
Well, you cite the socialists as being a corrective. Well, two things. During the last election, many critics of the current administration said we do not want to have European-style socialism. But the second thing is there such a thing as European-style socialism? If you look at what's going on in all of the major industrial powers of Europe other than in Scandinavia, and even to some degree in Scandinavia, we're seeing a move away from socialism, if anything, cutting back on social services to a drastic degree.
Well, corporatism hardly ends at the borders of the United States. However, having lived many years in Europe, the healthcare system in France is just a much more efficient, equitable, and fairer healthcare system than the one we have in the United States. The prison system in places like Finland, there's almost no recidivism because they put a lot of money into therapy, education, all that kind of stuff. So, I lived in Switzerland and we didn't have homeless. Now, of course, we were taxed about 50% of our income. But those who were less fortunate within our society were taken care of. And you're certainly right that that is throughout Europe under assault. However, I think the cruelty of American society, and I think what you just mentioned about unemployment benefits possibly running out. Well, unemployment benefits run out, then you're going to, courtesy of Bill Clinton's welfare reform, attempt to live on $143 a month.
Last week, one of my guests on the show was John H. Adams, the founding director and later president of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He's worked his whole life to protect the environment, and his approach has been to work from within the system. Do you say that's not a legitimate approach?
It's not worked. That's the problem.
We have seen environmental protections enacted, and to some degree because of his organization and others like the Sierra Club.
And we have seen a dismantling of those protections, I would say, over the last few years, certainly under the Bush administration, and very little has been done to rectify that under the Obama administration, the refusal to renew Kyoto being perhaps the most egregious example of that.
Well, Obama wanted to have the renewal of Kyoto, didn't he?
Well, he did.
Go ahead. I mean, Bill Clinton couldn't get it passed through Congress.
It didn't. Well, I'm talking about going to Copenhagen, where they just signed off on measures that in essence said, we'll worry about it later. I mean, it's not – that's not something, as Bill McKibben and others have pointed out, that time is running out. We're all sitting around pretending it's not going to happen.
Chris Hedges is the Pulitzer Prize-winning former foreign correspondent for The New York Times and other publications. Author of a number of books. Now he's a fellow at the Nation Institute and a columnist for Truthdig. And his latest book is called Death of the Liberal Class. It's published by Nation Books. I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks, Leonard.